great founders increase their locus of control. They don't place bets on things that they hope will pay off. They increase their locus of control. That's the fundamental approach. That's the non-scalable approach.
Hey, podcast listener, even if you are alone in your entrepreneurial journey, know that today, right now in your earbuds, you are joined by thousands of entrepreneurs from all around the globe seeking to grow better, more profitable, location-independent businesses. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and download our entire back catalog, check out tropicalmba.com.
Happy Thursday morning, everybody. Welcome back to the TMBA podcast. Welcome back to the podcast, boss man.
Yo, here we are.
Wow. I got all these great lengths to add energy to the Thursday morning, and you give me a low yo.
Here's why I'm upset. You want to hear? Very simple. I've reached the age where I wake up before my alarm clock. That's it. This is not how I thought it was going to go for me. I've always been a person that wakes up late, that stays up late. It's something's changing.
You know what I do when I need to pick me up, Ian? I take some Rob Walling essence vis-a-vis the Startups for the Rest of Us podcast, and I put that shit right in my ear. I mainline it directly into the dome. I take the Rob Walling wisdom, and I always walk with something from it. The other day, he was doing an episode, and he was referencing how influential Paul Graham's essay called Do Things That Don't Scale has been in the entrepreneurial world. It's been so influential that people quote it regularly without even knowing that they're doing it. And I thought to myself, the concepts in this article, Do Things That Don't Scale, actually are incredibly relevant to the episode we wanted to do today. So today we're exploring this psychological effect that I think a lot of founders have where we feel the desire to gamble on a long shot, to take a risk, to take some capital that we've earned and place a bet. And there's something exciting and freeing and thrilling about the concept of taking some money and putting it on an idea with the concept that could pay off big. We started to discuss how that rhymes with another activity in life. That activity is gambling. I think a lot of us as founders, we take gambles. And we waste time and we waste money on gambles. And I started to think that this concept of doing things that don't scale is specifically about not gambling, is about great founders do something we'll call increasing their locus of control. That actually they're doing things that are, we talk about as risky, but what they're really doing is doing a lot of things that don't work. It's not necessarily risky. So I think there's a lot of conflation between this concept of being an entrepreneur and taking, quote, risk with gambling. And I see a negative correlation to founders who gamble regularly. And I see a positive correlation to founders who increase their locus of control, take, quote, risks by failing, actually, not risking a ton of money, and doing things that don't scale. So I thought it would be interesting for us to revisit this highly influential article, talk through it, and then get to a listener question that is related. All right, Ian, if you're not familiar with Paul Graham, he's like Startup Buddha. He founded Y Combinator, which is the most famous startup accelerator on the planet Earth. Its brand equity at this point is on the level of something like an Ivy League, which is to say that if you got accepted to Harvard and accepted to Y Combinator, you'd have a real think on your hands. You know, it's not like, oh, obviously you're going to go to Harvard. A lot of people would elect to go to YC over an Ivy League school.
Crazy to say that, but yeah.
I think it's worth pointing out because I think me and you were both hanging out on Hacker News when it launched, right? It was like initially an idea. The first batch had former guests on the show, Einar Volset was in the first batch with a company that didn't end up working out. He's now the co-founder of TinySeed with Rob Walling. Shout out, funny how that works. Also, Airbnb was in the first batch. I remember you were early on the Airbnb thing. you had this instinct. I remember at some point you were like, look at this. You can go on the internet and like sleep on other people's couches. And then you said something I didn't expect you to say, which is, this is awesome. You were totally into it. I was like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Like, why would you want to sleep on some stranger's couch? That sounds horrible.
And then I followed up by not buying any Airbnb stocks.
It's the classic investor's dilemma. Should I buy stock or pay my rent? I'm going to go with rent this month and then stock next month. All right. So in Paul Graham's famous article, we are going to dig in and see if we can find some new inspiration in 2024 from these ideas that have persisted. I will start with Paul's own introduction. He writes, one of the most common types of advice we give at Y Combinator is to do things that don't scale. A lot of would-be founders believe that startups either take off or don't. You build something, you make it available, and if you've got a better mousetrap, people beat a path to your door as promised. Or they don't, in which case, the market must not exist. Actually, startups take off because the founders make them take off. There may be a handful that just grew by themselves, but usually it takes some sort of push to get them going. A good metaphor would be the cranks that car engines had before they got electric starters. Once the engine was going, it would keep going, but there was a separate and laborious process to get it going. Do you want to weigh in on the car metaphor? Is that accurate? I know you're taking notes over there.
I am taking notes. I was actually thinking of an airplane too, which is like same idea, which is like, yeah, build the airplane, make the wings, but you got to figure out a way to propel it. You got to figure out some kind of engine for it. And it reminded me of like these guys that make these ultralight airplanes and they strap them on and they run with their feet. Have you seen these? Run with their feet and then they jump off the cliff and then they basically ride the thermals up and float around.
It's actually a point that he brings up in the article, which is airplanes don't fly. There you go. It's a cone, as they say in China. Riddle me that. Airplanes don't fly. Think about that one. It'll drive you nuts.
They're propelled.
That's right. They are propelled. Airplanes are propelled. They do not fly. Birds fly.
Yes.
Not all birds fly.
Right. So Paul Graham wrote this article, gosh, Dan, it's got to be like 10 years ago.
2013.
So 10 years ago, exactly. And there's a reason why we're rereading
That's
it.
That's 11 years ago, exactly.
Oh, sorry. I'm still writing the wrong date on my checks, if you haven't noticed.
So 10 years ago, not exactly.
There's a reason we reread this stuff is because it's still relevant. You go back and you reread Paul Graham's essays and you think they could have been written today. And so I read this article trying to actually poke holes in it. Oh, something must have changed between now and 11 years ago. Like, well, there's AI now, or there's this, or there's that. No, nothing's changed. This is still as relevant as it was when he first wrote it.
Yeah, it's weathered the storm of reality and worked itself into the zeitgeist, and that's a signal of its strength. It reminds me of the Lindy principle, which is the concept that the amount of time something, you can predict something will be exist into the future is roughly, as a rule of thumb, the amount of time it existed in the past. So, will people read the 4-hour work week in 200 years? Probably not, because they've only been reading it since 2007. Will people read the Bible in 200 years? Probably, because they've been reading it for the last 3,000. I remember I had this experience when I was in college. Someone put Lao Tzu in front of me, this guy from China that he lived thousands and thousands of years ago. People still read this stuff. I crack the book. I start reading it. I think to myself, this guy could be sitting right next to me. In fact, he has ideas regarding wisdom that outpace anything I'm seeing coming out of the bookstore on the weekend. What is it about all of this knowledge that we've accumulated over the past 3,000 years that doesn't seem to hold up to what someone was saying 3,000-4,000 years ago? I think it's really interesting that not all knowledge and information leads to wisdom.
Clearly, he didn't know how to operate TikTok, which
that's right,
would make him pretty much irrelevant today to most people.
That's right. We'll have to do a whole episode about Lao Tzu. Let's stick to the modern day Lao Tzu, Paul Graham. Let's talk about the 10 concepts that don't scale. The first is recruiting users manually. Recruiting users manually. Okay, so what I think is interesting about each point, by the way, is that there's psychological reasons we don't want to do this. And we're comparing this with the psychological reasons we want to gamble. Doing things that don't scale is the opposite of gambling. It's controlling the outcome. He gives the example of the company Stripe. They developed a little term called collision installation. You'd think of Stripe as a company that could just sit back and let people sign up. But in fact, what the founders did, instead of asking customers to sign up for their beta, they would say, give me your laptop and I will sign up for you on your machine. And this is just this early day hustle for what has turned into an incredible, scalable, valuable company. Paul offers two reasons why founders resist recruiting users manually. One, and to quote him, is a combination of shyness and laziness. In other words, they don't want to be rejected. Make sense?
Yep.
And number two is that it's daunting. Founders ignore this path because the absolute numbers feel so small at first. How many people can I reach out to in a day? Is that ever going to lead to the scalable outcome that I dream of? The big return that I dream of? It won't. Therefore, I won't do it. I believe that great founders do the opposite, which is they compress time and they get that crank going by reaching out to 100 people a day. Does it scale? Can you do it for the rest of your life? No, but you can do it for a few weeks or months. And great founders do that. That's the difference between gambling and expanding your locus of control. I can't control the outcomes, but I can control 100 emails a day.
I think we can all relate to this one, especially the shyness, laziness, and rejection. There's something appealing about building, obviously, and not having to interact with people, and then having somebody magically find your product and then write you a huge check.
Yeah.
I mean, the thought of that is just so sexy.
It's appealing, yeah.
And the amount of times that has happened is basically zero.
Zero times. Yep.
So I don't know what book we were all reading when we thought that would work. It's like just to spend all your time building this thing in your mom's basement and, it was Field of Dreams. That's what it was. It was Kevin Costner.
Yeah. If Kevin Costner builds it, they will come. That's the thing. But he's got equity. He's built up a reputation.
Yeah. So just remember, we're not building baseball teams. We're building companies, right?
All right. There you go. The number two thing that doesn't scale is this concept of building something fragile. So as Paul writes, the big danger is that if you build, you'll dismiss your startup yourself. He gives the example of a baby. Looking at a small, fragile, non-robust entity and dismissing it is the same thing as dismissing a small baby who is one day going to grow up into an adult. And he says even founders themselves dismiss small, fragile ideas because they don't appear robust. So he says the question to ask in an early stage startup company is not, is this company going to take over the world? And I just want to highlight, I want to pause because we're going to get to this later in the episode. But this is exactly the question that most founders are asking, most would-be founders. They want to know that the company can take over the world. He says the question you should be asking is how big could this company get if the founders did the right things? Just hanging out, because sometimes simple things are very hard. There's a difference between is the company going to take over the world versus how big could this company get if the founder did the right things? And a way to add a little meat to that bone is we're talking about, can you do the right things for this company? Do the right things that don't scale. Can you do the non-scalable things? And are you the right person to be doing them? Can you execute? Is it within your locus of control? And that is a difference. That concept of founder fit is a difference between gambling and taking agency and control over a small business.
When we were discussing this episode, Dan, we had these intense conversations about gambling versus investing. And I personally don't gamble much, although I did the other day at the rodeo because there was a pig race. And for me, that was a perfect opportunity.
Yeah.
But for the purpose of this episode, what we're talking about here in fragility, this is the boring stuff for me. Man, you say that, and I'm so bored by the idea of having to work in my business and have things be small. No one ever wrote a movie about what happens in the beginning and the middle. It's always the end, right? Everybody celebrates and there's checks going around and champagne and all that stuff. This is so boring.
It's hard to tell yourself a story. Yeah, I think you're really nailing something important here.
It's no surprise nobody wants to do this.
Yeah.
It's no surprise nobody's attracted to this.
100%. That's why they never have made a documentary about this stuff, by the way. Because
man sits down at his computer for 10 years, doesn't make any money for the first 8.
Yeah. Stares at coffee for 90 minutes, waiting for caffeine intake, continues to send emails. The worst. Why would anybody want to do this? Nobody wants to do it. That's why they don't. That's our opportunity. Okay, number 2 is fragility. Number 3 is delight. Paul says, you should take extraordinary measures not just to acquire users, but also to make them happy. He uses the example of the form company, Wufoo. They sent each new user a handwritten thank you note. Your first users should feel that signing up with you was one of the best choices they ever made. And in turn, you should be racking your brains to think of new ways to delight them. Why do we get this wrong? Typically, Paul guesses that founders think they're supposed, and I'm quoting him here, by the way, they're supposed to build things that are robust and elegant, not be slavishly attentive to individual users like some kind of salesperson. Which, by the way, in the article, he says, if you're a founder, that's exactly what you are. I have never seen, and this is, I bolded this in my notes, I have never once seen a startup lured down a blind alley by trying too hard to make their initial users happy.
As if it would be a waste of time to delight your customers after they have paid you.
And there's the saddest moment in this essay here, Ian, which I'll quote directly. And cue the small violin sound effect. But perhaps the biggest thing preventing founders from realizing how attentive they could be to their users is that they've never experienced such attention themselves.
Oh, man. Now we're getting back to childhood trauma.
That's right. This is where the trauma comes in. I'm building a brutalist startup that is clean and efficient and robust.
Couple of things here on the delight side. I think he didn't say this right out, but when we're starting these companies, we tend to try and operate like a larger company. So there's like 5 divisions here. You might not know this, but I'm going to send you over to accounting, or this is customer service, or hey, I'm sales. Now we're going to go over to product. Meanwhile, it's all the same person. That's okay. That's cool. If I'm a customer, I get all of your attention in all those departments. I don't get to be passed around to all these different people. I get to just deal with you. I think that that's fun, especially as somebody that's like started a couple of these companies before. I understand that that's the process that it goes through. So I think trying to act like a larger company in these situations is a mistake, big time.
Straight up.
And then on the delight side of things, as Paul mentions, a lot of the stuff isn't scalable. So delighting your customers might be spending more money on them or more time or more attention than you would in the future. And there has to be some kind of payoff for that. And the payoff for me in these situations is that you get to know your customers intimately, understand their problems intimately, talk with them to understand the next thing to build. So if you're delighting somebody, chances are they're happy with you. And in return, you will probably get more information or more of their time, which you desperately need in the stage of your startup to figure out what the next thing is that you're going to build.
Also, you need NPS, baby, which is a fancy way of saying you need people talking about your jam, because that's the most expensive thing that startups need is new users and distribution. I remember when I signed up for Lemonade Insurance, and buying insurance is like the most unexciting concept in my entire week. And I got to do a lot of bad shit, but buying insurance is pretty much the worst. I had a friend one time that called it in case shit. That's what I'm buying. I'm literally have to anticipate and pay money for shit things. It's the worst. I buy Lemonade Insurance. They make it fun. They make it simple. I am delighted that I have bought this insurance. They send me a funny picture on the internet. Guess what I do? I talk about it to everybody. I'm talking about it on this podcast. Go buy Lemonade Insurance. It's fun. It's easy. And guess what? The reason I'm talking about them right now, that insurance that I bought, I've submitted a claim because I had a horrible life. Shit happened. Finally, shit happened. So I go back to the insurer and I say, guess what? Shit happened. And guess what they did? Sent me a check with a funny photo. I was happy. They were happy. Everybody wins. Go buy Lemonade Insurance. But that's the main reason. That sort of thing is priceless. And that's why you want to go out of your way to delight your customers. Big companies can't do that. You can.
You know, you're recalling the insurance incident. There's so few of these things that happen in our lives with the products that we buy. So when you can take the time to stand out through delighting your customers, things like this are going to happen.
100%. All right. The number four thing that doesn't scale is experience. So this concept that not just the product needs to be great, but the experience of being your user needs to be great. Experience is closely tied to delight. I'm going to move on to fire. He calls it fire, but on this podcast, we call it niching until it hurts. So basically, he writes, sometimes the right unscalable trick is to focus on a deliberately narrow market. It's like keeping a fire contained at first to get it really hot before adding new logs. The classic story of this is Facebook at the Ivies. But we call it niching until it hurts and parlaying forward, which is focus on enthusiasts. Focus on people who are, I like this word, avid. People who are totally loving what you're doing might seem unscalable. But it's really often the case that products, in our company, we call it the Nike shoe principle. The Nike shoe principle is that Nike's going to go out there and put these kicks on the best athletes in the world. You know, people who can run the 100-meter dash in less than 10 seconds. Guess what that means? These shoes are designed for that purpose. I'm going to wear them when I'm going to Costco on Friday night. Now, eventually.
That's right. And you're going to call them your drip. That's right.
I'm going to put these kicks on because I want to be basking the glow of that 100-meter time. And Nike started with a small fire, which is runners, elite runners. And it's not immediately obvious or, quote, scalable for founders how that is going to parlay out into the global brand as it is today. And that is a truth that exists on everyone's desk right now, which is that start a fire, protect it from the wind, niche until it hurts, and you can always buy the next domain name or parlay it forward into the next niche. Facebook, think about Facebook in a Harvard dorm where Facebook was an actual thing, right?
It was called the Facebook.
The Facebook was a thing that Harvard had before the Facebook had it, right? Like the Facebook was like the yearbook. And so the idea when you're thinking about that, it doesn't scale. You go back to the beginning moments of the first fire and it doesn't feel like it scales, right? If you can find that intensity, that delight, that moment, you might actually be on the right track.
It doesn't scale, but it could.
There you go. That's it. That's what we're trying to figure out. Here's the next one that I think will resonate with you, Ian. Polina Meraki, which is named after the founder of a company called Pebble. But for the purposes of this podcast, I'm going to call it pulling a shown. And so a shown is when you essentially fabricate your product yourself. Because in the early days, it's hard to get contractors, manufacturers involved. And this is specifically for hardware startups. But he writes, like paying excessive attention to early customers, fabricating things yourself turns out to be valuable for hardware startups. You can tweak the design faster when you're at the factory and you learn things you never have known otherwise. Of course, the modern day example of this is Elon Musk sleeping in the Tesla factory and focusing on these details actually speed up velocity in that initial crank quite a great deal.
It's one of the more interesting parts of his biography, I thought, just from being a product guy and a manufacturing guy in a past life, is just watching him micromanage his supply chain. Because he could control his cost and because he could control the quality and the speed.
The number seven way we can do things that don't scale is we can consult. Another consulting-like technique for recruiting initially lukewarm users is to use your software yourself on their behalf. Sometimes, and I'm quoting Paul, sometimes we advise founders of B2B startups to take over engagement to an extreme and to pick a single user and act as if they were consultants building something just for that one user. We call this the anchor client. You cross the line when you charge for it. It's an interesting distinction because then they expect you to do everything. So we talk about this all the time, Ian, as the concept of an anchor client. It came up a few episodes ago when Jordan Gal from Carthook and now Rally gave us a call and handed us the product on a plate and said, look, I need a recruiter that can get me somebody in a chair within 30 days because I'm sick of my leadership team doing recruiting, but we need somebody we can trust completely. And he handed that product idea to us. That's the concept of the anchor client.
The temptation here, Dan, to turn into a consultant is so appealing because you get this anchor client and they have all these demands. And then you're doing all these things that we mentioned above before, right? Which is creating a nice experience for them, delighting them. And then they get the sense that like, oh, these guys work for me now. This is great. I have their attention. And then you're thinking like, well, our product, like I'm not sure if it's going to work out. I could just charge these guys like $5,000 a month, make custom integrations for them. So the temptation is there to become a consultant. But I think as soon as you do charge for that, which is what he's saying, and then you start to become a consultancy. It's like the same reason when I leave my house, I'll have somebody come stay for free just to look after things versus putting it on Airbnb. Because as soon as you put your house on Airbnb, you have customers.
Yeah, that's true.
And the relationship completely changes.
Yep. This is why I won't stay in people's houses for free either, by the way.
Exactly.
I'd rather pay and have this relationship where I have any leverage whatsoever.
Exactly.
All right. Let's keep it moving. Number eight thing that doesn't scale is going manual. And he's talking in the case of software startups where essentially what you do is you have a phantom feature that when the user clicks on it, in the background, there's just a bunch of you guys just with spreadsheets and sticks and bubblegum figuring out how to deliver on that. There was apparently a famous example with Stripe where they delivered, quote, instant merchant accounts to its first users. That was actually the founders manually signed up for them for traditional accounts behind the scenes. So this is just classic, we would call it hustle, but this concept that you don't have to have everything buttoned up in the early days of a startup. What you need is key customer behavior. That's what you're trying to prove. If it means that you have to have your phone buzzing 24 hours a day to respond within an hour to like an early feature, then that's what it means. Like that doesn't scale, but you need to know now whether this is going to work or not. That's the idea of doing something that doesn't scale.
And you know what? The customer doesn't care if you're doing things manually. The reason they're coming to you 9 times out of 10 is because they had a bad experience with the large company that does have this automated already. They found you, they've reached out to you, something's different about you, and they want to try it. So if you don't have every single feature that the bigger company has, they understand that, right? And that's the reason they're coming to you in the first place again. So I think that the temptation here is to have everything look like it's buttoned up. The temptation here is to have all the features that everybody else has. If you were to do that, if you were to compete on that scale, it would cost you just as much as it would your competitor. And you can't afford to do that in the early days. That's why you're here doing things manually behind the scene, is because you cannot afford to build out all these features.
Yeah, it's also a good reason to not build the features that your competitors have and not make that your sort of vector. We'll get to that of attack or vector of differentiation. That's actually a really interesting point we're going to talk about in terms of gambling, which is investing capital to essentially recreate what incumbents have done is, well, how can you compete with a better capitalized company? What's your perspective about that? You have to have a strong perspective. And typically, founders will feel it's table stakes. Would-be founders feel those things are table stakes. And so they do them, but they do it with like poor execution. They're years behind. less capitalization. And because there's no real moment of like it's working or it's not, they feel like it's table stakes. It's a great way to lose a bunch of money, essentially, which is like modeling the features that all your competition has. A couple more points we got here. Paul mentioned sort of an anti-point, which is launching. To quote him, I should mention one sort of initial tactic that usually doesn't work, the big launch. I occasionally meet founders who seem to believe startups are projectiles rather than powered aircraft, and that they'll make it big if only they're launched with sufficient initial velocity. So why do founders think launches matter? A combination of solipsism and laziness. The world revolves around you, and I don't really want to work that hard, which is, we're building out this segue into gambling, because there's also sort of a solipsism to gambling, which is you're waiting for that big payoff, which is like the hand of God taking that pointer finger and pointing directly to you and saying, I agree with you. that the world does revolve around you. Please bet again.
I agree with you. It's worth $4.
He also has kind of a throwaway point here at the end of the big launch point, which is partnerships too usually don't work. They don't work for startups in general, but they especially don't work as a way to get growth started. We have a similar concept here. We call it just another Wednesday, which is to say that that big thing that you've been working on with that annoying so-called market leader who's been stringing you along through a buying process for 6 months or whatever, it's probably not going to pay off. This is another way that would-be founders disassociate from a locus of control. They want to participate in what the big company is doing. We've got a deal. Whatever you get on a call with a founder who starts talking more about other brands than their brand, you know it's not going to work out. Oh, we got something going with so-and-so that you've heard of. And I'm talking to this person over there and they're going to do this. And it's like 9 times out of 10, I'm just like, this is disassociative talk. That's a locus of control that exists in another city, in another company, and you don't control it. And it's probably not going to pay off for you because it's going to pay off for them. That's how that works, typically. And so I think it's pretty interesting that on like Word 1500 or whatever, it's sort of just buried in this beautiful article. By the way, if you're depending on some kind of key partnership for your new business to take off, probably not going to work out for you. It typically means that you're such a young company, you're so fragile, that if you're in a partnership so early in the game, it's probably not going to work out that great for you because you don't have that much equity. You don't have pricing power. You don't have much going for the startup. So you need to be typically a little bit more diversified in the early days and not depend on one key partnership, although exceptions abound. I think the interesting thing to look at here is these are the rules. This is what has persisted over time. And certainly this echoes with what I've seen. Is it is a red flag when you hear about big partnerships early in the game. Why? Why? Because that's thinking of businesses like a trajectile versus something that needs consistent propulsion.
Getting back to the plane metaphor, Dan, you have it in the hangar, but before you even have it in the hangar, what do you have? A pile of parts and building an experimental. Great. Pile of parts. Start putting the pile of parts together. Let's put the engine in it. You start the engine. Maybe you have to crank it. You drive it out onto the taxiway, right? You're taxiing around, then you get to the runway, and then maybe you take off. All this stuff happens, the launch, the taking off, all of that happened before you even took flight, right? You had all your customers before that. You had a product that worked. You're doing things manually. You're doing things that don't scale. And then you have this launch. Everybody just wants to take off. Have you ever seen a plane just take off from the hangar, just assemble itself and shoot right out of the hangar? No, it doesn't happen.
This again reminds me of why there's no documentary. Like, imagine if it took 2 years to get to the taxiway. That would suck.
Yeah. You'd be like, this is the, it does exist on YouTube. And this is how most of us spend our Friday evenings at this point in our lives is watching the plane get assembled.
Are you talking about the vertical takeoff jet that the Navy has? Because that's an exception to your rule. And that's what my startup's going to be. So screw you.
Exactly.
All right, the final concept that doesn't scale is something he calls vector versus scalars. So Ian, this is way above my IQ range. So I'm going to try to bring it down a little bit to something I can chew on, but I could get it wrong. I believe that the concept of vectors versus scalars for Paul operates similar to Derek Sivers' idea of the concept of ideas versus execution, and that it is how they interact with each other's ideas and execution that ultimately leads to your trajectory, your flight path, your result. So he writes, the need, this is an important quote, the need to do something unscalably laborious to get started is so nearly universal that it might be a good idea to stop thinking of startup ideas as scalers. Okay, that's where he lost me. When he said as scalers, I'm like, man, I failed calculus. I had to go into liberal arts. Instead, we should try thinking of them as pairs of what you're going to build, plus the unscalable things you're going to do to initially get the company going. So a scaler has one dimension versus a vector has two values. The unscalable input versus the thing that goes along the scalar line, which would be, say, for example, volume is a scaler, trajectory is a vector. You can double check that.
I'm also barely holding on, but I'm with you.
The bottom line is that you have the scalable thing is affected by the unscalable thing, and the combination of the two is what creates the vector, the direction, the flight path of the startup. It's not along one dimension. And so you can think of them as interacting to determine a path forward versus a single value that goes forward. Another way to think of this, I think, is to think of Derek Sivers' ideas and then execution. You have an idea, but then how do you execute it? Those two things operate as a pair. The quality of the idea, the quality of the marketplace gets adjusted by the quality or multiplied by the quality of your execution. So it's a different world, different way to think about the concept of pairing it off. I want to just put a little bit more meat on the bone here. In the best case, both components, and quoting again, the components of the vector contribute to your company's DNA. The unscalable things you have to do to get started are not merely a necessary evil, but change the company permanently for the better. So if you had to be super aggressive in the early days about customer acquisition, that tends to be baked into the DNA that then gets executed 10 years later. And we see this kind of stuff a lot in businesses. So it's not merely a necessary evil. So in its own small way, the actions you're doing that don't scale, scale to a degree because they get baked in to behaviors down the line. I want to revisit this quote. And I think maybe he's saying in an article that has become part of the zeitgeist that we still reference today, and I quote, the need to do something unscalably laborious to get started is so nearly universal that it might be a good idea to stop thinking about startup ideas as scalers. We all drop off there. Most of us drop off there. You have to have a 135 IQ to stick with that. But the point, he's saying this is universal from his perspective. And this is a theme that keeps coming up is having your unscalably laborious moment in time. And as we talk about business ideas and opportunities and moments of timing in the market that you could get involved in, it's often like, I'm going to be on this wave. I'm going to put my money down on this color. My number will come up. When you hear people talk like this, when you hear ideas like this, that sounds more like gambling. But what's the locus of control? Is the unscalably laborious moment. You hear more people talking about the market and less people talking about their own energy and effort. If you get a call from two founders and one's telling you about the big deal and the market, and the other is telling you about their personal habits, you bet on the personal habits. And that 100%. To me is the takeaway of the article, is that it is your behavior and your locus of control that is more likely correlated with a positive startup than with an understanding of something in the market. That's it. You need to understand, don't get me wrong, you need to understand something about the market. You need to understand there's a game to play. You need to understand the rules of the game. But simply, if your personal habit is placing a bet, that makes you an investor. If your personal habit is doing something unscalably laborious, that makes you a startup founder.
All right, Dan, I want to get into this because I don't get to hear a lot of these like conversations we used to hear 15 years ago, like, oh man, I got to get into this. The opportunity is now. I'm going to build this thing. Like, have you seen what the market's doing? There's all these startups. Like, I don't get to participate in those conversations anymore. I remember having 15 years ago with you. It's like, oh man, we got to get into this. It's the new hot thing.
Yeah.
And we would convince each other and then we would think about it and then maybe we wouldn't do anything about it. But I'm not a huge part of those conversations anymore because that was a bunch of dreamer talk.
It's rookie talk.
And I don't dream anymore. I just do.
The dreams are dead, man.
Exactly. The dreams are dead. But here's what happens. And this is what we're going to get to is you get a little money, you get a little time, your business is doing okay. You find yourself a little bit freed up. And what do?
You slip down to the business equivalent of Atlantic City for the weekend. That's what you
exactly.
do.
Exactly. Exactly. And you start dreaming again. And you start to forget all the ways in which you were successful. Because now I'm a little bit older. I don't want to really grind. I got some money. I could just pay somebody to do this.
Oh, that's the best.
They could find the customers for me. They could talk to the customers. What? You can't talk to the customers?
Well, here's the thing, though. There's a version of what you're describing that actually works. And that's the version that's within your locus of control. And so the problem is when you get a little bit older and you have a little bit of money, typically, you don't have enough money to do the sorts of ideas that you're talking about. You got to understand your founder fit in the world, your locus of control, and what the sort of outcomes you can actually generate. So, hey, if you want to sit on the board, like Paul Graham stuff, you got Paul Graham money, you can bring in elite founders. You can invest in 10 of them and then double down on the one that works. The next level is getting something off the ground and bringing in an elite CEO. There's a world for all this stuff. Typically, what we're trying to do is find the shortcuts, and that's the gamble, right? And that's where you start losing money, losing time, and having opportunities not work out in slow motion, right? Because most of this stuff's not going to work out. Better for you to control it, figure it out fast. And again, it's amazing to me. It's almost like if you were to chart this stuff out, the more worried you are about what other people think and the more lazy you are, the bigger the ideas you talk about are. And then when you talk to hyper successful people, all you hear about are freaking details.
I made a supplement that addresses acute knee pain in the rear of the knee. $10 million a year in revenue. Yep.
There you go. All right, Ian, let's take it full circle. Today, we spent some time revisiting an article that has made itself into the canon of entrepreneurship, a must read. It's called Do Things That Don't Scale. There are 10 things that don't scale. Recruiting users manually, fostering a fragile being, delight, an incredible experience, a very narrow and focused fire, niching until it hurts, pulling a shown, aka building your own products. We didn't even tell the story of how you built our earliest products yourself, and how that led to a great deal of innovation for us. Save it for another pod. Consults, doing software manually or delivering your product manually, vectors versus scalers, or a combination of ideas and execution, or ideas and execution being somewhat equally weighted and being dependent on each other. And then we also have the anti-point of the big launch or the big partnership that typically doesn't work out because that's projectile versus propulsion. The reason we wanted to talk about this today is we have all these stats here about the growth of gambling in America. And I think there's a reason why 1 in 5, I mean, look, gambling is a global pastime on the scale of very few other pastimes. And I think there's something psychologically seductive about gambling. And so many of us say, well, I don't gamble. I know the odds. Then we step right into our businesses and we gamble. And Paul Graham is saying in a way, that doesn't work. You need to do things that don't scale. And when I thought about this episode last night as I was walking around, I wrote on the board here, I said, great founders increase their locus of control. They don't place bets on things that they hope will pay off. They increase their locus of control. That's the fundamental approach. That's the non-scalable approach. And it's something that I wanted to take the episode today to reflect on what that can mean for each of us. There's something psychologically hard about facing the failure, facing that grind, the thing that feels laborious, that this is actually the likely path of success and not the shiny hope that you can disassociate from and hope returns to you gold. I'm going to put a little bet over here. I hope it comes back gold. Fair enough. I understand it's seductive. But Paul Graham, this generation's Lao Tzu, is saying that is not typically what we're seeing from our best and most successful founders. There you go. Do Things That Don't Scale by Paul Graham. He's a legend. He wrote this in July 2013, and we are reading it in March 2024. Not a word I'd change at this point. Shout out Paul Graham. Come on the podcast, Paul. We'd love to have you. All right, Ian. That's it for this week. See you next week.
All right, Dan.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Tropical MBA podcast. You can go to tropicalmba.com, get access to hundreds of back episodes and all kinds of other goodies. Load up your iPod. That is the cheapest way to fly business class on your next international flight. We will see you next Thursday morning, 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.